21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
It's all about soul. It's all about faith and a deeper devotion. It's all about soul. Because under love is a stronger emotion.
Welcome to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Zohara Hieronymus. Lar Kortner is our executive producer and research assistant, and Noah Dankner, well, he makes sure we're on time. He runs our board from our host station. Stefan Schwartz joins us this hour for a continuing conversation about the world of consciousness and the world we call society in a changing spectrum of challenges and options. Stefan's books and research papers on remote viewing and archaeology, anthropology, medicine and healing, creativity and social policy can be found at his website, stefanaschwartz.com, his newsletter, theschwartzreport.net, and explorejournal.com/content/Schwartz. So, Stefan, last hour we really touched on just a variety of trends, all of which are terribly challenging. Earth changes, the demographics of billions of people on the move, crumbling infrastructure, conservative theocracy, separatism, exclusionaryism. I mean, all things that don't necessarily lead to a very bright future. And when you look at the enormity of challenges we all face individually, nationally, collectively, planetary-wide, there is no way to approach the future without our working together. That's the bottom line, and that's why I used to say that Earth changes, the silver lining will bring us together. And I used to say that about terrorism, and it drove political analysts crazy when I would say these people want attention, just like a child wants attention, not saying they're children, but it's people screaming for attention in general, and that it will bring the world together. So let's look at some of the things you have, because worldwide, once upon a time, way before our time period, the intuitive arts were highly valued. The shaman, the seer, the little girl who could hear or see things that nobody else could see, the young boy who was taught at a young age how to be a tracker by sniffing the wind or using his dreams. Our intuitive tools are really gifts that we have that are really phenomenally essential for our surviving the challenges we have on the physical level. So let's talk about that.
Okay. Well, the important place to start, I think, is we tend to place intuitive skills in a kind of cul-de-sac, when in fact what we're really talking about is opening our consciousness to an aspect of ourselves, what you might think of as the eternal you. This is the component of our consciousness which is non-local. That is, it is not strictly limited to our physiology. I mean, I know this drives materialists crazy, but the fact is that the evidence for this is quite overwhelming. There are, for instance, 6 standardized protocols in consciousness research that have been carried out at universities and in scientific institutions all across the planet by dozens of researchers, and that they collectively, each individually, have odds that they are occurring by chance that exceed 1 in a billion. And to give you a sense of proportion, the decision whether to acknowledge the existence of the Higgs boson, which occurred recently, was based on odds of 1 in 300 million. So these are 6 protocols, each of which is 1 in a billion. And these are remote viewing, being able to describe persons, places, or events from which you are physically or temporally separated, staring, that is, knowing that someone is staring at you and causing brain linkage. Another one is presentment, which is an important one in terms of what we were talking about. These are just a little before you actually have the stimulus, your body reacts to it. You're not even cognitively aware of it. A typical experiment would be you're staring at a television monitor and there's nothing there, and then periodically a random number generator throws up a picture, and just before that happens, the iris of your eye dilates. So these protocols, and by some calculations there are 9 of them, are all telling us that there is an aspect of consciousness that is not limited by space-time. They are also telling us that that all life is interconnected and interdependent, and that relative to the point we made in the last hour, that we live embedded in the biosphere of the Earth. We are in a matrix of life of which we are simply a component, not the component. If you look at the research, for instance, I've done a great deal of research comparing the relationship of scientific genius, moments of genius, breakthrough moments, spiritual epiphanies, and what we call psychic functioning. And what you see when you do this is that these are all the same thing, modulated only by intent and context. That is, a scientist is trying to see some kind of physical principle or process, and so that's what the experience is like. The spiritual pilgrim is trying to have knowledge of that transcendental self. That's the experience they have. It differs based on their religious beliefs, maybe, or something else, but it's the same experience, and it is the same experience that the psychic has when they do a remote viewing, for instance, or a healing. These are, when you listen to what these people who have these experiences, the Max Planck, the father of quantum mechanics, Wolfgang Pauli, one of the Olympian physicists of the 20th century, Einstein, when you listen to what these people say when they describe these experiences, they tell you that they experience it as a timeless time, a spaceless space. It's as if they were connected to all that is and that they could get any information they wanted. Brahms says, when I'm in this altered state of consciousness, I hear the music just like Beethoven or Mozart or Copland. We have an aspect of ourselves that survives corporeal death. This is the part that survives, the part that has the near-death experience when the brain is not functioning. This is the part that comes back. We are more than animated meat. And when we recognize that, and we recognize that all life is interconnected and interdependent, and that's the emerging paradigm that's coming, then we make very different choices, because we no longer see the world from a sort of dominionist position. You know, it's ours to exploit. Instead, we see it as a cooperative effort in which all the various life forms are interacting. And when we don't do that, when we fail to do that, for instance, the acidification of the oceans as a result of CO2 emissions and the death of the coral, and the breakdown of the great fisheries because of overfishing and the destruction of the ecosystems of the ocean. When those things happen, then we place ourselves at great peril. And so I think that the first place to start this sort of what can we do and what is positive is to begin from recognizing that we are part of the matrix of life and that it is incumbent upon us to choose those things which are life-affirming.
Yeah, I loved what you said last hour as of your own barometer of asking yourself before every decision you make, these choices we're given in life, whether it's what we buy, what we eat, what we drive, what we say, what we don't do, what we choose to do, is it compassionate and life-affirming? The Buddhists put it as dependent co-arising, or in this, you know, upcoming thing I'm speaking at, it's called The Coming Singularity, or Larry Dawsey's recent book, One Mind.
Yes, all of these expressions of this same realization, which is beginning to bubble up.
Mm-hmm. And the beautiful thing is, before you pass that point, because sometimes people think that, oh, yeah, you all sound great, sounds real good. But the beautiful part about what's happening, having now been a part of this sort of transdimensional, transconsciousness, transspecies development over the last 50 or 60 years, is to watch the science begin to explain how it is that everything is one, that these aren't just mystical spiritual concepts, but very real physical descriptions of phenomena as big as cosmos and as small as the atom.
Yes, this is very important. What's happening is that in a wide range of scientific disciplines, physics, medicine, biology, resuscitation medicine, parapsychological research per se, that in a wide spectrum of scientific disciplines, many scientists, including scientists who start out as very militant materialists, when they actually look at the data that is accruing from their experimentation, they realize that consciousness is a thing unto itself. As Max Planck said, consciousness is primary. Materiality is its manifestation. You cannot get behind consciousness. It is the beginning. And once you begin to see that it is consciousness that is the issue, then, first of all, it empowers people, because it doesn't matter whether you're rich or you hold a powerful job or you're a famous person. You can make a difference just in the choices you make, and you can see this. Look at just give you one example I just noticed in the last few months. In the last 6 to 9 months, we have given up gay and replaced it with a much more inclusive term, LGBT. Now, how did that happen? Suddenly, everybody says LGBT. You see it in the press. You hear it on television. That didn't even exist in popular awareness a year and a half ago. How did that happen? And it happened because people heard it, they resonated with it, and they began using it. They made a choice. The whole move for marriage equality that 10 years ago would have seemed unthinkable, we now realize is a trend which is occurring faster than we could possibly imagine. And why? Because people react to the innate fairness of it. They respond to it in a positive way. We can see all across the spectrum where you give these life-affirming impulses support, you, yourself, give these support by talking about them, by making choices that support them, that great social change happens. Look at smoking. When I was a boy growing up, you went to somebody's house, and on the coffee table there was always cigarettes and one of those Ronson lighters that only seemed to exist on coffee tables, and ashtrays. When was the last time you went into a house and there was an ashtray on the coffee table? Why did this stop? Because people made individual choices. And it is in that power of the individual choice that the future lies.
And the beautiful thing as you speak about it is that when any one of us sits quietly, I love the way Deepak Chopra tends to guide people through these kinds of things. He's very gentle and seems to have this capacity to show everybody that all of these concepts are not new, and it's not just that they're ancient, it's that they're innate. And that when any one of us sits quietly and feels the wind or comes into rapport with a flower or a child or an animal or a human or a cloud or, you know, whatever it is, that is an opening to that capacity. And I think that's one of the reasons, Steph, and I've so appreciated the scientific work on prayer by the Spindrift Institute and others, by William Sweet, and, that to show this capacity that each one of us has wherever we are, that when we speak an intention that is positive and affirmative out loud, it is an actual instrument of change that affects the molecules of that which we have focused our attention on. And so whether
That's right. We know from over 2,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature that the consciousness of one individual has the power to affect either positively or negatively, and it's important to recognize that, either positively or negatively, the well-being of another organism from single-celled organisms all the way up to high-order mammals, that the focused intention we hold has an effect on well-being. We know, for instance, that individuals can focus their attention, their intentioned awareness. Intention is the key here. Focused awareness is the mechanism. That's why people who are meditators do particularly well at parapsychological psychic tasks, because they have the ability to hold intention-focused awareness. And so when you can hold intention-focused awareness, you are a powerful being. As I say, we know that people can influence the growth of bacteria. They can change the power of hemoglobin to not break up. We know that there is brain entraining. Gene Okterberg, for instance, a researcher who was studying Kahuna Priest, showed that when the healers were focusing their attention on the healees, who didn't know when it was happening — these are rigorous, double-blind, randomized experiments — that when they did that, the healers were some distance away, that there was a particular brain activity that occurred in and only in the brains of the people who were the recipient of healing, and only when the healing was being sent to them. So there was a form of linkage that occurs. We know that focusing both powerful negative intention and positive intention can produce effects, although those which are life-affirming tend to do better than those which are not, because life seeks a continuing stasis. So we don't tend to think about that very much. We talk about healing. We talk about it in religious terms, but we don't really give a great deal of credence to it in terms of it having an effect in our lives. And yet study after study shows that where individuals hold therapeutic intention for the well-being of another, that their immune system improves, that their functioning improves, that they have healing. It's the oldest belief humanity has. You see the idea of healing as an intention that dates back all the way back as far as we have human record, that our consciousness makes a difference. And we innately know this, even though we may not articulate much belief in it. Innately, we do know this. And Roger Nelson, for instance, at Princeton, who's doing the Global Consciousness Project, has been looking at when a big emotionally charged event occurs — the death of Princess Diana, the tsunami in 2011 in Japan — that where these powerful emotional events occur, people all over the world react to them. And Roger has random number generators spread all over the planet that are feeding into a common matrix. And he shows that these random number generators, which are very specially designed to only be random, go non-random when these events occur, and that the odds of this happening by chance, again, are better than one in a billion. So we are all consciousness is interlinked and interdependent. And once you get that, well, that changes your whole worldview.
And it also, as we have to take another break, but it also tells us the importance of what we listen to and why so much of the hypnotic mind control that goes on both subliminally, as you've pointed out, and we've talked with Nick Begich recently about the technology that sort of mind controls us and also puts us into an emotional sort of suspended state where you're not even in touch with your feelings. But on the other side of it, sending loving thoughts to somebody that you see in distress across the street. Or sending, you know, loving thoughts to the group of people at some other nation in a flood, that these are real things and don't allow anybody to ever tell you it's not a powerful addition that each one of us can make. We're going to take a brief break, then we'll be back with the most articulate, wonderfully spoken, intelligent, amazing guest, Stephen A. Schwartz, after this.
Hi, this is Dr. Jacob Lieberman. I'm author of Light Medicine of the Future, Take Off Your Glasses and See, and Wisdom from an Empty Mind. Much of my work is helping people to experience their maximum potential. And you can contact me if you need to at jacoblieberman.org. That's Jacob, LIBERMAN.org. You're listening to Dr. Zohara Hieronymus at 21st Century Radio, and I'm so glad to be with you today. Aloha.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. All of our guests and all of our shows are archived online at www.21st21stcenturyradio.com. Please share any show you find of interest with friends and colleagues. Joining us currently is Stephen Schwartz. You can follow up with his amazing work at Stephen A. Schwartz, SCHWARTZ.com, also the SchwartzReport.net and explorejournal.com/content/Schwartz. So, Stephen, having looked at the choice before us of either shutting ourselves off from the divine talents we have, which are non-local, outside the bounds of time and space, that make everything and anything available to us, as my dowsing teacher, the late Terry Edward Ross, used to say, that we have the capacity to see everywhere and every when. And when we access that field, whether as a dowser, a remote viewer, a healer, or somebody doing prayer, it's also important to ask, may I? Can I? And should I? And I have found that those three questions are also what we need to apply to community development, to technology. So I wanted to ask you to sort of combine a few things for us, as only you can do. When you look at the use of, for instance, remote viewing and the use of non-local consciousness, how can these capacities and utilize them affect group activism?
Well, the first thing you have to we have to start with, Zoe, is presentment. This is a big deal. You know, we now have there are several dozen in the peer-reviewed literature studies looking at how people have a sort of psychophysical reaction to something before it actually happens. I was describing that earlier.
Yeah. I actually just had that experience. We had big storms here, and before the electricity went out, you know, it just seemed everything was fine a little bit. I said, I think I should make a fire in the wood stove. And then a generator started, and before the generator went off, my entire body like went through shudders like a minute before, and then the generator shut down. My body literally went through what the household went through when the generator shut down. It was fascinating.
Well, that's at the individual level.
Right, exactly.
But now let's take this up to the next dimension, and that is the social level, because as I was saying earlier, you look at Roger Nelson, for instance, at Princeton's Global Consciousness Project, and where he's looking at the mass response to events like big crisis events, you know, the Princess Diana's death or Nelson Mandela's death, that kind of thing, you realize that we have, because this is a function of being alive, that we have a kind of mass social presentment about coming crises, climate change being, of course, perhaps the most powerful, because even though we may not even believe in it, we have this sense that something foreboding is coming, which is a source of much of the fear that's going on. And we should also say that, you know, there's a great deal of neuroscience research now on the role of the amygdala, which is a small part of the brain. And we find out that people, about 27% of the population, have essentially overactive amygdalas. And the amygdala is associated with fear, with foreboding, a sense of intolerance, all kinds of sort of non-PC things to talk about. And research has shown that there is a correlation between the function of your amygdala and what political party you belong to. Republicans overwhelmingly belong to, people with overactive right amygdalas overwhelmingly belong to the Republican Party. Our conservatives have a lot of fearfulness. And this fearfulness needs to be recognized because it's not a rational response. This is a deep primordial response that these people are having. Whereas other people who have a more compassionate, tolerant, free will sort of operation, they are really much more directed by the insula, another little part of the brain. I mean, the tests that they've done, tests that were done at the University of Exeter and at Brown University and Penn State University, for instance, showing that you could take the test and you could be 82.9% effective in predicting which political party someone would belong to. So we need to realize that there is a neuroscience to this as well, and that people who have this presentiment that something is coming, that they are stimulated into a fear, rigidity, a sense of anxiety. It's existential. They can't really define what it is, but they feel this very strongly. And so we need to recognize that this presentiment phenomena, which we see in the laboratory at the individual level or in our day-to-day lives, just as you described, that this plays out also at the social level, and that we need to begin to recognize this and to help people work with this, because it's a powerful factor in their psychology. And there's study after study has come out about this now, this business of the overactive right amygdala. We are, and it's hard for people to take this aboard, but we are animals. And our physiology responds as animals do. And we need to recognize this and recognize that the fear that this produces in people needs to be dealt with in a compassionate way, because if it isn't, then we get, for instance, the psychosis of guns that we have in the United States, where, you know, in the period of time that the Iraq-Afghanistan war, that decade, about, I don't know, 5,500 men and women were killed on the battlefield. And during that same period of time, 270,000 Americans were shot by other Americans. We have this war going on, an epidemic of violence that is just, I mean, it's a form of psychosis. And we refuse this denial you were talking about earlier. We simply will not address it directly. And consequently, we we've gotten to a point where it's the new normal. I saw a thing on television the other night about when I was a boy, we used to have the atomic, I'm sure you, well, maybe you're not old enough, but when I was a boy, you were in school, and then you'd have the duck and cover drill. It's pathetic when you think about it, but, you know, we would all be taught to crouch down and cover our heads. Now we have the school lockdown drill, as if it was normal to have people with guns come in and shoot up our schools. We've had, since Sandy, we've had, I think it's 43 or 44 school shootings. And this shooting business arises out of this sense of fear. So we need to develop social policies that recognize that we are not every man for himself, that it only works properly when we recognize we're all in this together and that we are all responsible. We are our brother's keeper, our sister's keeper, and that when you have strong social policies, you have healthy, happy people. And you can see this in other countries. I mean, as I said, you know, when we first started today, we are not a happy country, and it ought to be important to us. Why aren't we a happy country? What can we do to become a happy country? Does that not make any difference?
Yeah, and when you look at the barometer of healthcare, you know, as Americans, particularly those of us who grew up in the 40s, or I'll speak for myself, I was born in the mid-50s, 54, and I was so totally brainwashed. Completely, that America's the best, America's the greatest. There's no better nation on earth. There are wonderful things about America and Americans, but the truth is our health care is lousy, whether it's Obamacare or Affordable Care Act or any other act you want. Yes. It's industrialized health care, and it's death management, illness management. It's not a wellness-based protocol or perspective, and the same thing with our housing availability or with the quality of our food. Have somebody come from a European country and talk about how plastic and disgusting most of our food is, unless you buy organic and, you know, and you really are thoughtful and choose where to get what you get and know how it was grown. I mean, all of these things come back to what you talked about, individual choice. And this individual choice, though, when one has a mania, which our whole society does, and that our corporation is a psychopath, and that the government is psychopathic. And that was, I remember the studies that I reported on years ago, that the government is a sociopath, and that some of our presidents have been sociopaths looking at their behavior. So we look at this kind of abnormal imbalance, left-right hemisphere, reptilian brain, and other brain parts when one is predominant as somehow or other being okay. And if it's not okay, we prescribe highly lethal, dangerous pharmaceutical drugs to young boys who in their adolescent fury are the ones that pick up the guns and go shoot up the schools and kill other people. And it's not really talked about that these, they talk about mental illness. They don't talk about the other drug destruction that is happening in our country with psychological drug warfare.
Yeah, I mean, again, it all flows from this. Profit is the only social priority. Again, I'm not against profit, but it is very clear if you look at a spectrum, you just cited a whole spectrum of things. Every one of those things you just cited, the medicine, the mental illness, the education, all of that, all of it flows from the fact that we have made profit the only social consideration. And we have got to get to a place where we make national wellness our priority. How can we create healthy, functioning human beings? Because if we can't succeed at that task, we cannot succeed as a society. Society is made up of individuals. It's not some abstraction that's outside of us. We are a society, and if we cannot develop a society which values wellness and which places wellness as our first priority, then we are not going to survive. There is great historical evidence You could look at a book like Collapse, Jared Diamond's book. You know, you ask yourself, what did the last guy cutting down the last tree on Easter Island, a culture that was dependent on trees, think that he was doing? We say to ourselves, well, if it was that bad, we'd do something about it. But the fact of the matter is, we are conditioned to, first of all, be in denial about it, and second of all, to feel powerless that we can't do anything about it. In fact, we can, and we must, because if we don't, then we are not going to survive. If you look at American society and you consider children, the next generation, to be the purpose of a social order is to create healthy children that will carry that social order on, we are failing miserably. Our children are ignorant, they're obese, they're ill. We treat little boys as if being a little boy was a disease and medicate them. Just in area after area, you see over and over again the choice to make profit as opposed to creating wellness. It astonishes me that something so obvious doesn't seem to penetrate people's minds to realize we have other choices. We can make other choices. It does not have to be this way. Other countries can do this. Why can't we do it?
Amen to that. We'll be right back. Our guest is Stephen Schwartz, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio.
Hi, this is Dr. Bernie Siegel speaking to you for 21st Century Radio, Dr. Zohara Hieronymus. She's top quality, as is her program, speaking about consciousness and opening our minds to what I think will be the future of both medical care as well as how we care for ourselves and each other and really begin to understand ourselves. And my latest book is The Art of Healing. Bless you all.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Zoe Hieronymus. Our website, www.21st21stcenturyradio.com. For those of you in the local area of Maryland, please join me on Sunday, March 9th at 1 p.m. at the American Visionary Art Museum. There'll be a mini conference called Human Soul and Machine, The Coming Singularity. I'm the opening speaker. We'll be joined by visionary artist Alex Gray, Rebecca Hofberger, the museum's founder and director, Martine Rothblatt, an advocate of technological immortality. And I'll be doing a book signing with my third book, The Future of Human Experience. So for just a $5 registration fee, you can have a tour of AVAM's grand new exhibit, Human Soul and Machine, and join us. Again, that's Sunday, March 9th at 1 p.m. at AVAM. Pre-registration is required, so do call 410-244-1900. That's 410-244-1900. You can also visit AVAM online at www.avam.org. Stephen Schwartz has been with us all evening, and he will be until we say goodnight. StephenAschwartz.com, SchwartzReport.net, explorejournal.com/content/Schwartz. So, Stephen, we spent the first hour this evening looking at the very serious problems we face, both in terms of disposition, denial about infrastructure, denial about separatism, racism, fear, anxiety, that we have other choices and that our capacity as humans to love, to share, to support, to restore is really what's being called for all of us. You have a beautiful CD that is on your website, Opening to the Infinite Experience, Your Own World, Tomorrow, Today. Share with us a little bit about what a listener can find there.
Well, thank you, Zoe, for mentioning that. I've done actually several CDs that arise out of the research. You know, I'm a data-based person. I'm a scientist, and so data is important to me, and the things that I do are based on actual research, not on some speculative idea that I've got. And as a response of requests that people gave me, I've put together some CDs. One is on a technique of meditation. because if I could wave a magic wand and do one thing in the world, if I, you know, the fairies came down and gave me one wish, it would be that all children are taught the technique of meditation, not a religious technique, but simply a mindfulness technique, because the research on this is just simply overwhelming. There were over 1,000 papers published in the peer-reviewed literature, medical literature, between 2006 and 2009, as an example, on meditation. We know that if one meditates for a cumulative amount of just 11 hours, that your prefrontal cortex of your brain thickens, you get smarter, your IQ goes up, you concentrate better, you sleep better, you have lower anxiety, your blood pressure goes down, your sex life improves, your dream life improves, your capacity for concentration improves. So if I could wave a magic wand, it would be to teach people to meditate, and there are lots of ways to do it. I simply have developed a technique that comes out of the research itself. It's non-sectarian. So I did a CD on that. I've done another one based on all the therapeutic intention research, the healing research, and the placebo research, which doesn't normally get considered in this way. And in this CD, it's called Harmonic Healing. It's about stimulating your immune response so that you are healthier as an individual and you can address illnesses or particular physical problems. We know, for instance, in the placebo research, that people have the ability to control their bodies down to the cellular level. Otherwise, placebo wouldn't work. And so I've tried to encapsulate that into, incorporate that into an experience. I have another one called Looking Into Your Future, which is an adaptation of the remote viewing techniques, which allows you to go forward in time to date in your own future, to remote view yourself and get a sense of what your life will be like in the future, and then you can make choices that will allow you to manifest that and live into it. So my CDs in general are all designed to do what we've been talking about this evening, and that is to empower individuals to really take control of their lives and be able to do something significant with them. I don't mean to get famous or get rich. I mean, that might happen. But to feel that you are making a difference and to recognize who you are and that you are not some powerless consumer. You are actually quite powerful, and you have the ability to change not only your life but the lives of others. And because I think we are a society, and a society is made up of individuals, and so the place to start is at the individual level. And if individuals change, then society changes.
Absolutely so. I mean, that it's sort of been my premise since sort of being an activist and then finding you can't change the world by banging it down. You know, you really can sort of bang down your own prejudices within, which are not necessarily the overt kind. Some of them are just, you know, a lack of sensitivity to the need of a bird that is doesn't like the particular seed you put out because it's not the seed they eat, whatever it is, you know. And I think that's the beautiful thing about coming into a self-awareness, because then you appreciate that everything you come into contact with during the course of any given day in a life is purposeful. The person you met at the grocery store, the person you spoke to at the gas station, the person you thought of who you haven't thought of and they died 10 years ago, and then you think of the grandchild that the person, you know, whatever it is, that these aren't just random. Somebody asked me, did I believe in randomness? And I said, I can believe in things that when they're sort of in a non-coherent state, but it's all coherent purposefulness to me. And that it's not just some sort of accident. They asked me if I believed in coincidence, and I said, no, I really don't even believe in what some people refer to as coincidence, because I think the whole universe, as Deepak Chopra once said, the whole universe is conspiring for you and I, Stefan, to have this conversation. So I want to just, though, finish on one question I had mentioned, which is, It occurs to me as an activist, and I interview numerous senior activists who, like myself, have been doing this 40 or 50 years, and how to sort of maintain one's hope and joy over doing the right thing, even in the face of such great adversity and such challenge. I open up my email today, and it's the wolves being decimated, or the bees dying, or the dolphins, or the whale, or the birds, or the this. Right. And it can be extremely disheartening. And so it always dawns on me that love is the greatest action of all, this question of compassionate, life-affirming things, love. And so can you just address for a moment this vision I have of prayer being a part of activism? You know, there's a lot of activism, and we call senators, and we make a lot of noise, and show up places, and do what we have to do. But there's another level of activism I don't think yet has been done. And I believe that this kind of non-local activism, where each of us from wherever we are on the planet, if coordinated at a certain time and moment, would have a powerful impact.
Absolutely. A measurable impact, actually. I mean, it's quantifiable. Yes, I mean, part of what makes meditation important is that it teaches intention-focused awareness. And I recommend that you end your meditation by sending out healing to the people that you are, that you care about personally. Not that you have a cherished outcome, but that you pray that for the best that will happen to them. That's very important, because our visualization of what might be best for them is by definition finite, and we don't control all the information. There are things they don't tell us, you know, whatever. But you can never go wrong praying that the best that could be possible for that person may happen, that which is best for their souls, or however you want to frame that. So I recommend that after you build the focused awareness that meditation gives, that you end by sending out healing, and that you see things which matter to you, broad systems, or, you know, whether it's dolphins or bees or whatever, you see them prospering. You see them in wholeness. You see them improving. These intentions, because the key to the game is that you be able to hold focused, intentioned awareness, that you hold clearly a coherent intention. And if you can teach yourself to do that, and it's not easy in some ways. It's very easy to go through the motions of it. It's harder to actually do it, because most of what we do most of the time is reactive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not doing anything original. We're responding the way our parents taught us, society taught us, our friends taught us. We don't actually stop and think, well, now in this situation, what is the compassionate, life-affirming thing? We just respond. So most of our activity is reactive. Almost all spiritual paths talk about being in the moment, but they're never very clear about what does that actually mean. And what it means is that when you are in that moment, that you make your choices based on that which is compassionate and life-affirming, that you just don't respond to the programming that you... You know, we're like a computer that has apps that run us most of the time.
Exactly.
We have to take control of it. And if we will do that, not only will our life get better, but the lives of all humanity will get better. Wherever you are, the people that are listening to this, whoever you are, however much money you've got, what race you are, what religion, what sex, none of that matters. What matters is that you are a being capable of holding life-affirming intention.
Amen. Stephen Schwartz. Follow up, www.stephanaschwartz.com, schwartzreport.net, explorejournal.com, content/Schwartz.
Stimulating talk around the clock and breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore, and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Bill Vitka.